asked to pay the real costs of their impacts. They've never been asked to do that before, and that's one of the reasons the river is so darn degraded today. It sets a precedent that is likely to be carried forward. We don't expect that this will go away. We expect that 2 years from now, the same arguments will be made, and it will be carried forward, and perhaps in a different model, but it will be carried forward. It also perpetuates a system in which industry doesn't use the best practices because they don't have to internalize the impact, the costs of their natural resource impacts. Instead, they get to move it to the taxpayers or not pay it at all. We don't believe the taxpayers should pay for this. As has already been noted, these industries have done well over the past 10 years. They've tripled their income. The river plan already promises nearly $500 million in gray infrastructure to support industry in the North Reach, $400 million of which is expected in the next 10 years. It's not appropriate to ask the taxpayers to pay the cost for natural resource mitigation for these industries that are primarily responsible for the polluted and degraded state that the river is in today, especially at a time when we're watching things like parks and police and fire being cut and having sustained cuts year after year after year. The last thing I would add is that this plan, and this is something I think industry and Audubon do agree on, expects the city to step up as well and pay for part of it. There's a huge gap that industry is not going to pay for, and it's going to be on all of our shoulders to make up that gap. The fees, the subsidies shouldn't go to industry. They should go to complementing, not subsidizing industry. I'll just end by saying we've watched the integrity of this plan dwindle for the last 2 years, first with the restoration fees, which are cut to virtually nothing, second with the inclusion of numerous standards and exemptions. Now this really strikes at the core of the plan, so we don't see that there's much left of what we initially worked on for so long. Thank you.
Bob, Linda?
I want to reiterate what Bob Salinger has said and others, that I'm particularly concerned about the 50% subsidizing of the fees, because a lot of money is going in to create the infrastructure. The industry will be benefiting from that, and particularly if the money comes out of the general fund, where we're already. I served on the budget committee for parks for several years, and the money's not there to do just basic, really desperately needed maintenance. And so I really just feel this is not an appropriate use of general fund monies.
Thank you very much.
So just to clarify, we don't know where we're getting that $500 million for the infrastructure from. So it's like the $600 million for the bike plan, right? Is that right, Mayor? We have a commitment that
or
we
have. Or billions for auto traffic improvements.
We understand that those are the infrastructure needs, but we haven't a plan for the next 10 years for how we're going to provide that money.
So how can you offer it?
It's identified as needed projects, but it's not yet funded.
Yeah. And that is true for almost every aspect of city government and federal government and state government. So sorry if that sounds shocking, but we don't actually have the money in hand for the next 10 years worth of infrastructure needs, and neither does any other government. Steve.
Mayor Adams, members of the council, Steve Pfeiffer here today on behalf of Sensor Steel Industries. And hopefully on a more positive note, and I offer the written comments that were just handed out to you in my brief summary today, in a positive vein. First of all, we do commend the direction of council on the in-lieu fee and the work that staff has done to date. The work that staff has done has been extensive. It is absolutely addressing the issues that we've had and raised, and I think it's a good step in the right direction. Secondly, we do have concerns, you've heard it today from others, on the industry side that we may be in a position, if the fees are too high, we'll have less incentive to capitalize the projects, and then in turn the river and other environmental aspects suffer as well. Having said that, what we would request is that you defer action today and allow us a chance to work some of these issues through. And one good example of those is apparent today from the resolution, the modification to the ordinance on the delta between detailed concept to detailed planning and the contingency. That was a discussion, I think it may have grown out of a discussion that we'd had with staff here just within the last week, where we pointed out that our understanding is that while a high contingency is appropriate at a concept plan level, as that plan moves to detail, the contingency, be it a public or private project, diminishes. And there didn't appear to be any way to account for that in the methodology. And then today, we see a response to that. And I offer that really as only one example of some of the problem solving that I think could occur to address the issues that we've raised. It's not a question, at least in our minds, of whether we should compensate and pay for those impacts. whatever they may be, unavoidable as they must be in a project. We do not, in many cases, want to put those on site because it'll further inhibit redevelopment or development of that site. In some cases, as you're aware of, there is no room on site for that, so we'll default to those. So the point I'll leave you with is I really would urge you to give us a chance to work with staff, put all the stakeholders, public, private, conservation included, in the room at the table, and I think we can come up with some of these solutions.
Respectfully, I'm a big fan of yours and a big supporter of the industry, as I am a big supporter of the environmental goals for this part of the city. And I do believe, as I've said repeatedly, both can be achieved. And the way we've set this up moving forward, once it's implemented, you don't have to take my word for it. You don't just have to take my word for it, because we have set up an oversight committee of all the stakeholders so that this discussion will continue. But respectfully, the only time that I feel like I've gotten clarity is by continuing the basic R&D work. Your industry said, don't move forward with the R&D work on the in lieu fee at our last council hearing. And we wouldn't be here today to be able to clarify how much contingency, or you wouldn't have the raw material to ask the questions to clarify so that you would find out, and we would all find out, how much contingency there is. But because we provisionally adopted a path that said that the staff has to go through a certain amount of research and evaluation, it's only because of that, over the objection of your industry, that we are here today having made movement, because you wouldn't have anything to respond to. I just want you to know that it is with continued forward motion to get to clarity, to get to the facts, to get to the best possible forecast ahead, and continuing to polish as we go, is the only thing that has worked here.
And with all due respect, Mayor, I agree with you. And all I'm suggesting...
Let's just stop there then.
Instead of making it a single-phase approach, let's make it a two-phase. We received the package, and we received a thorough package on the 3rd of November.
And you're going to have months ahead, and you're going to have stakeholders sitting at the committee with the NORAD, is that what we're calling it? NORAD, to continue to look at, to continue to polish the finalization of these things. And we will continue the oversight of that. To say to not make decisions is what you said last time, and no progress would have been made if we followed the general advice that we got from the industry last time.
Whatever last time may have been aside, what I'm suggesting today simply is that before you put those in detail, lock them down, and put them in an ordinance, in a fee schedule adopted by an ordinance, give us, I'm not talking months, I'm not talking a long period of time, but give us the chance to work through this. Frankly, we did not have a seat at the table in the generation of this methodology, and I can understand why.
And that's
why
we
do need that information, but now that we have it.
And that's why we're going to, if council agrees, that's why we're going to continue the work of engagement, partnership, and getting to the best understanding of the facts based on research, evaluation, and we will get there. This is not the end. You thought last time was the end, that it was just like you wouldn't, no matter what we said, you wouldn't pay attention to the words provisional. Well, this work is provisional until the required initial steps are taken, and you will be along as part of that. We now have more time for that, and there is a process in place as part of this set of resolutions and ordinances to do that. So I want to reassure you, you will continue to be at the table. We want to try to get this right. Thank you.
The last two who signed up for these first three are Mara Gross and Peter F. Fry.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Mara Gross. I am the policy director at Coalition for a Livable Future. CLF represents nearly 100 groups working for healthy, sustainable communities in the Portland area. We represent a broad array of interests, including affordable housing, transportation, hunger, environmental justice, and others, and also including Portland Audubon, who's been key to creating a thoughtful and balanced plan. And CLF also participated on River Plan Committee. I'm here to echo the concerns about the subsidizing 50% of the in lieu fee. concerned that we don't know how much it's going to cost taxpayers or where the money in the budget's going to come from. Economic development should support sustainable business practices, and it should be strategic, and concerned that instead it's subsidizing the failure to clean up the river. You know, major point of the river plan is for industry, rather than taxpayers, to finally pay the real costs of environmental impacts, and the river's in such bad shape, in part because we haven't historically done that. And the river plan's a good example of addressing the true costs of development rather than externalizing them, or at least it was before this amendment to this resolution. As you well know, the city's key programs are, due to this recession, the city's key programs are sustaining budget cuts. And this resolution amounts essentially to a further cut. We don't know where it's coming from, but to cut these programs and services to pay for industry's pollution doesn't seem like a good answer to me and to our organization. The plan's been in development for nearly a decade. The amounts were worked out over months. They were independently verified. And yet this last-minute changes, if it goes through, will have happened without a public process. And I hope we at the city can have a better process and a better use of public funds. Thanks.
So to be fair, we subsidize the introduction of sustainable practices. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And I view the 50% credit as an opportunity for us to do this. We're definitely, as you've heard from testimony, going into a period of 2 years where there is not a lot of trust on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
And all sides cite good reason for that. But we have, as you said in your own testimony, initially subsidized, especially when there was a lot of uncertainty about it, the implementation of our environmental goals. This is for 2 years. And during that time, we have to do more work to figure out a permanent mitigation bank. And again, oversight for that will include representation and advocacy from the environmental community. In terms of trends, mm-hmm. during that take into account the best of economic times and the worst of economic times, staff thinks that it would be $225,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want people to be left with the impression it is not an insignificant amount of money, but it is something that I think is doable as an incentive for both the economy and the environment. Thank you. Peter?
And if I just might add to that, we're coming back in January with a funding strategy, so there will be more public process on this. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Peter Finley Fry. I'm a planning consultant for Gunderson. I hear you say it's 2 years, but I see this more as trying to create a framework of partnership between the industry and the public. And so this framework, I think, needs to be defined as carefully as possible. I've submitted a letter that identifies some of the things that I think are missing. The first one, and I'm just going to summarize, I don't see the goals clearly stated in this report. And as a planner, it's important to state your goals up front, which I consider are restoration of the river, restoration of the watershed, and integration of human activities, particularly those activities that are fundamental to the very existence of Portland. The document is not really clear as to the nexus, and that's just a minor point you can work out. There's some concern about how the fee in lieu process, again, I'm looking at the long term, because even though this is only 2 years, I think this is going to become a model to the future. I think the document needs to become more consistent. The spreadsheet results in different conclusions depending on who uses it, because there's too much discretion in doing the spreadsheet. So that needs to be pinned down a little more. From my point of view, because I do a lot of permitting in the river, marinas, and things like that, there's no critical path identified in the report in terms of the permit process. A linear process, typically, you go get the land use, then you get the state, and then you come get the building permits. That should be in this so that we understand that process and understand how it works. I think there should be more choice of mitigation. The most important thing to me is pretty anal, but the contingency is not properly applied, because a primary project goal is to have no contingency. The contingency is based on risk, and ideally when you're finished, that contingency is there and not spent. And so there's no provision for putting that money back in. And then obviously you heard the restoration costs are too high. I sped through this because I'm new to this process.
And representing someone?
Gunderson, I said that at the very beginning of my testimony. I'm sorry, I should have been even clearer. And I want to make two points. One is I don't like the word subsidy because I don't think that's truly what's happening here. It's a partnership. Every one of us are responsible for the degradation of the river, and that's the other thing that bothers me is hear everybody say they degraded the river. It's their fault. They need to fix it. But every person that drives on city streets, every person that lives in the West Hills, every one of us is responsible for the degradation of the river. And without all of us joining together to go after fixing the river, we will never do it. We'll constantly have this polarization going on about us and them. It's their fault or it's their fault. And I really think that has to stop. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you both. Appreciate your testimony. Does that conclude those that have signed up?
Yes.
Staff, could you please come back to answer a few follow-up questions? Who's the expert on costs? So the 90% soft cost was raised. The fees are too high. The 10 to 30% capital expenditure costs. Can you talk about costs?
Sure.
Expensive sites was the other one.
Right. Mayor, members of the council, there were some questions about the in-lieu fee amounts and how those were calculated. And as I presented in the in our PowerPoint presentation, there's a hard cost of construction and then the soft costs and then a contingency. Those are the major components that go into the in-lieu fee structure. The again, I want to point out that the capital costs for the in-lieu fees are based on conceptual level planning for sites in the North Reach that are demonstrative of the kinds of restoration activities that we would need to undertake in the North Reach and the Pearl sites. So out of the gate, you have restoration sites in a highly complex environment, in an industrially zoned environment with much infrastructure that has to be accounted for, in addition to the fact that the river has been highly altered over time and a great amount of excavation would be required in the riverine and the riparian restoration components of the Pearl sites to level the river back to a 7-to-1 slope, which is one of the assumptions used in these restoration conceptual plans that are consistent with our restoration objectives in the North Reach. So out of the gate, we are working in a very complex environment with a number of costs associated with carrying out those activities. So the capital costs reflect those complexities. And again, they are estimates at the conceptual level, and I'll get into responding to how that figures into the contingency in a moment. How do we determine what the soft costs are compared to the capital costs? And in order to answer that question, BES undertook an evaluation of 7 finished, completed restoration projects that we have completed in different places in the city, ranging from Johnson Creek watershed to the Willamette River, including, for example, Stevens Creek, which is near the Selwood Bridge, Tryon Creek Confluence, which is outside the city limits but is a confluence habitat. We looked at the total life budget for those projects. And again, this is based on the accounting in our project accounting system. We looked at all of the costs that were assigned to those projects. We separated out for the purposes of this analysis which of those costs were hard costs, which of those costs were soft costs. We found a wide range among those 7 projects.
Can you just define a little more what a soft cost is?
A soft cost, again, as I mentioned in my slide presentation, is everything that is all costs assigned to a project that are not related to construction expenses paid to a contractor and initial revegetation. So what does that mean? That means everything that relates to architectural work, engineering, surveying, testing, permitting, other pre- and post-construction expenses are part of soft costs. So everything that's not directly related to paying a construction contractor to carry out the work or initial re-veg. When we looked at these 7 projects, the soft costs varied from a low of 39% of the hard costs to a high of 198%. There is a great variability. And again, this is looking at actual data. This is all part of public record And again, I want to point out to the council that the reason we're going through this process as methodically as we are is we want it to be transparent, and we want the assumptions to be able to be evaluated, and so we can have these discussions we're having today, as the mayor pointed out a few moments ago. So what we did was we looked at what would be a reasonable soft cost. And so we took the average of those seven projects. The average was 108% soft cost to hard cost. We took out the outliers, the upper and the lower. And essentially, without the two highest and the one lowest, we get an 86% soft cost. So we felt that in our best professional judgment at this point, based on actual projects that the city has carried out, that a 90% soft cost reflects the actual cost of carrying out those portions of a construction project. That's how we ended up at 90% for the soft cost. For the contingency, again, this harkens back to my original, yes.
Do you have an opinion then on these, the other lesser expensive sites or projects that were mentioned by the by Alan?
Oh.
Commencement Bay, Isla Bus Waterway, they said those discounted service acre year costs were $52,000, $67,000,
$125,000
respectively.
Well,
Sorry, councilors. My name is Caitlin Lovell again. For the record, I can speak to those other areas. Those were areas that were part of a Superfund cleanup process, and all of those, they only deal with one listed species and one regulatory agency. So our process is actually much more comprehensive, isn't intended to actually cover all of the possible implications to the environment and be creditable at the state, local, and federal level. So those costs were simply for one listed species, for one federal agency. We have not been able to find out what the additional costs were to satisfy the state and local agencies at the time. It's likely minimal because it was a Superfund process, whereas here we're talking about development. But in the event that those would have applied, it would have increased those costs.
So we're confident that those costs that were given did not include state or local government requirements.
Yes.
And the industry has asked for, which I agree with, of that notion of the one-stop mitigation bank, at least on a permanent, when we get to permanent mitigation banks. And the concern about slippery slope between temporary and permanent mitigation bank and in fee in lieu of, I just want to, you all agree that part of what the council is considering here is an RFP process for the permanent mitigation banks that will, the oversight of which will include the multi-stakeholder group we put together?
I believe that's a question. That would be managed by the Office of Healthy Working Rivers, and I believe that is their current intention, but I don't want to speak for them.
She's shaking her head, yes. No, that's right. That's just wanted to double check.
So, but before we get too far off this discussion, so this is an area that is fairly new to me with respect to ascribing costs according to this formula. So what is helpful for me is to compare apples to apples. So,
right.
I'm comfortable as we move forward. So if, in fact, the three comparators that were given, the $52,000, $67,000, and the $125,000, don't include costs that we may have in our discounted service acre year formula, can you isolate out what our costs are that compare to those costs and give me that comparison, and then itemize out those extra costs that you say are ascribed due to the extra species that we are trying to protect that those costs didn't include, so that I know we're doing, you see what I'm saying, an apples-to-apples comparison,
yes,
and that our costs are on par, at least in one aspect of the discounted service acre year formula, with what those other locales spent.
Yes, that will require some time to do the recalculation, but what we do have is what NOAA uses for one particular species here in Portland. We will recalculate it and run it through HEA and find out what the comparable costs and come back to you with those.
So that we're saying the same thing. I would want to make sure that that species would happen to be the same kind of species that these other local Chinook.
Yes, it will be for spring Chinook.
Definitely, so that I knew that we were comparing precisely the same kinds of protections here as we were there. And then I'm assuming one could extrapolate from that the extra increased costs with respect to the other species that you've said that we will be protecting with this fee that those other locales did not include. So I could extrapolate from that and get to the $235,000 that they've used.
With some assumptions, again, because we shifted from a species approach to a functional-based approach, the functions of the Willamette River are different than the functions of Puget Sound. So it's hard to say that our extrapolation would be comparable if they were to extrapolate it at Puget Sound. But we will get as close as we possibly can and still be as valid as possible.
And if you can't directly extrapolate, it'll at least explain why not.
Exactly.
So that I at least can understand what it is that I'm considering.
Certainly.
Thank you.
You were about to talk about the sites, I think.
Right. Well, the other component was the contingency.
Thanks.
And we used a 75% contingency in the fee structure. And the reason, again, that we used the 75% is because of the low level of confidence in the outcome of the designs that we have studied in the North Reach. They're in very early phases of design. And we're following the standards of practice in the city's capital improvements program process. And in the 2009 CIP handbook, there is a section in the handbook that regards the very topic we're talking about here. And that is called Project Estimate Confidence Level Rating for any project according to its phase in design or construction. It goes from a low confidence rating all the way up to a complete or high confidence rating. We are at the low confidence rating with regard to the initial restoration planning for those sites I mentioned in my PowerPoint, the Lamet Cove, Triangle Park, and Marcom, and the three streams. The low definition is the project scope is conceptual vision with limited detail. The project cost is an educated guesstimate, which is our best ability based on looking at survey data, looking at the quantities of excavation required, based on our level of survey, which we haven't actually conducted surveys out there. So that's another reason why it's low confidence. Specifications are still at infancy stage. There are no specifications yet developed for those sites. The total project contingencies, including project management, design, engineering, plus construction, may range up to or exceed 50%. And again, the reason we chose 75% is that we are in a very complex environment in the North Reach with high infrastructure issues and contamination, all kinds of constraints that would tend to make these projects complicated to carry out. So at this point in the design phase, we feel that 75% contingency is justified based on our standards of practice in the capital improvements program. As we proceed through the design process, that contingency will drop. And by the time we get to a complete design, it can be as low as 10%.
When will you have complete design?
We will not have designs, complete designs for the projects that were the basis of the in-lieu fees, because those are not ones we're going forward with in a detailed planning fashion. We're going to be looking at two other sites. At this current time, it's the Swan Island Beaches property and Siltronic. And we'll be having pre-design completed by the spring of 2011.
Thank you. And then did you cover, so we're getting down to two sites, and did you touch on the expensive site concern, or are those the two sites, and you've chosen those two sites because?
The reason we've chosen those two sites to go forward with is that, number one, we have either own fee title the land, which is in the Swan Island Lagoon Beaches property, or we will have a conservation easement pending action of the council for the Siltronic site, which would authorize us to work in conjunction with Siltronic to develop restoration plans.
Because we own it or control, by then we will control it, it allows us to not have to necessarily charge full cost for the value of land and to move expeditiously.
Those would be options, yep.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for our staff team? All right. We will move on to item number 1509 then. Who's going to staff? Who will provide the... So 1509 appoints the members of the Northreach Advisory Committee for terms to expire on 2013.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm pleased to introduce Ann Beyer, the Director of the Office of Healthy Working Rivers, who will tell us about this group.
Great. Good morning. Good afternoon. Ann Beyer, Director of the Office of Healthy Working Rivers. I'm very pleased today to present a slate of 20 applicants to serve on the Northreach Advisory Committee. These are people who come with years of experience and a passion for the river. This group will be charged with the oversight of the implementation of the Northreach Plan. And that is a sort of new way of looking at our planning process. We want to make sure that the commitments that the council has made are actually followed through on. We've talked about some of those today, the environmental goals, the economic development goals, the recreation goals, and reconnecting our neighbors to the rivers are all goals of the river plan that this group will be charged with overseeing how well we're doing. We will begin meeting in the spring, giving people some background. Many of these people have been engaged in the process since the beginning. Some are newcomers to the process. Again, they're here with a lot of experience. They don't come here with sides chosen. It will be a committee that will not be friends of the groom, friends of the bride. We will try to work on this collaboratively to really look at how well we're implementing things. So I'm just thrilled to have this group representing us. I think some of the folks are in the audience, and if they would like to stand up, that would be lovely.
Would you please stand if you've been nominated? Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And we do have members from neighborhood groups, industry, environmental groups, property owners, others with a broad regional interest. We are still open to adding more. We know there are some perspectives which are not yet represented on the committee. So if anybody wants to nominate further members, and would certainly be happy to accept applications.
Thank you.
And again, I understand this is a change in practice on these kinds of matters. We usually just pass. We have often in the past, in history, just passed or approved these kinds of ordinances, land use expectations, and then it was purely staff that dealt with property owners and stakeholders. This will be different, intended for much more month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter, active management and perfecting of our best initial thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone here wish to testify on 1510? This is about University of Portland.
Bob Solinger?
We didn't have the staff.
He's not.
Oh, do we need to have a staff?
We have a staff presentation on that, and then we have one on Siltronic as well. Brief.
Very good. Staff, please come forward to tell us about the agreement, draft agreement with the University of Portland to establish conditions and process by which the city will remove environmental conservation overlay contingent upon natural resource mitigation.
The UP one?
Yeah.
That one right there.
Okay, thank you for not going straight to testimony. My name is Marisol Caron with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with me is Paul Ketchum with Bureau of Environmental Services. And we will present to you the details of the ordinance and the draft development agreement between the city and the University of Portland for your consideration today. And as a note, we do have with us the complete record related to this ordinance. For some background, during the River Plan Northreach proceedings, the University of Portland described its future intent to build a gateway structure on a portion of the Willamette Bluff abutting their property. They requested that council remove the proposed environmental conservation overlay zone in this location because they did not want to be subject to environmental review alternatives analysis, and requested that the zone be removed from that identified spot. On April 15th, 2010, Council approved the River Plan North Reach, which did apply the environmental protection and conservation overlay zones to the bluff. At the same time, Council also adopted a resolution that directed staff to negotiate an agreement with the university that would be put before Council for consideration. And the details of that agreement would address the removal of the River Plan adopted environmental conservation overlay zone from that portion of the site, which has been dubbed the Gateway Site, in exchange for the university providing advanced mitigation consistent with what would be required through an environmental review process. Modification of an environmental overlay zone to facilitate planned future development is not an uncommon request through a legislative process. The use of a development agreement, however, is a new tool that staff was directed to use to evaluate the implications of this request and prior to the effective date of the plan, and to determine and require appropriate mitigation. The agreement before you outlines a mitigation plan that compensates for future anticipated development impacts to the wildlife corridor functions on the Gateway site. I will provide some background on the process we've gone through, and then Paul will go into some detail on the mitigation plan itself. Starting in August 2010, the city and the university signed a contract to begin work on the agreement. Work began in earnest in early September when staff from Bureau of Environmental Services, Bureau of Development Services, Parks, and Bureau of Planning and Sustainability met with the university campus representatives on site and did an evaluation of the campus, the Gateway site, and early identification of mitigation priorities and locations. And this included identification of mitigation goals and alternatives. Through October and November, staff worked on refinements to the draft agreement and presented a draft agreement, and public outreach occurred via a public open house that occurred on October 21st. That was followed by a presentation to the North Portland Land Use Group on October 28th. Information was also distributed electronically via the River Plan News and through a Bureau of Planning and Sustainability North Portland District Liaison distribution list. We held individual meetings with concerned citizens, and finally, mailed notice was sent regarding the City Council hearing. Public feedback and comments were heard, and many of the ideas were incorporated into the draft agreement and mitigation plan. Some examples of that language include provisions for the long-term protection, maintenance, and monitoring of the mitigation site, and also provisions that make clear the university's intent to incorporate sustainable design principles into their future design, including bird-friendly design, eco-roofs, and integration of the building footprint. And I'll turn it over to Paul to
talk about the mitigation. Members of the council, I want to just briefly review the mitigation plan, which is a central element to this development agreement. Just first of all, I want to outline the goals for the mitigation plan. They are to compensate for the impacts to natural resource values and functions that will result through the placement of a gateway structure in the escarpment. We want to restore and enhance white oak habitat, which is a special habitat of concern in the city of Portland. We probably have 2-3% of historic conditions of white oak left in the city, so there's a great deal to be accomplished there. We want to establish educational signage in this area to educate the public, and the university can display its interest in furthering white oak rehabilitation. And we want to produce a viable plan that will provide long-term benefits to the bluff. And by long-term, I mean over 100 years. I want to state at the outset that when we looked at this mitigation plan and developing it, we were starting from pretty much scratch. We did not have any particular mitigation ratio in mind, except that we wanted to at least have a one-to-one ratio, which is the outcome of most environmental reviews through the conservation plan zone. We looked for opportunities to restore white oak habitat on the campus-owned premises in the escarpment. And after essentially the bottom line, at the end of the day, we did develop a mitigation plan in conjunction with the university that results in a 4.25 to 1 ratio for mitigation, which is very, very high and is very good. And the staff feels that with the combination of enhancement of the bluff that is under this mitigation plan and the restoration of white oak habitat, that we will more than compensate for the detrimental impacts of the gateway structure. This slide will give you some of the details about the mitigation plan. Essentially, on the right-hand box is up there at the top right-hand is the gateway site structure, that's potential structure. The total impact area that we're trying to compensate for is 50,500 square feet of area, so it's about an acre and a half of area. It's 39,000 square feet of that would be to a proposed structure, and another 11,500 square feet would be disturbance area. So the total disturbance area is 50,500 square feet. Through the development of this mitigation plan, the university really looked at a larger area of the bluff to institute a mitigation plan, and essentially based it on an ecological look at the bluff and what needs to be done to increase values and functions in that location. So we'll break it into four component parts of the mitigation area. The most important area is the oak woodland restoration area. That's about 7,520 square feet. That's a mitigation ratio of 1.5 to 1 for the building. The white oak woodland, it would go into an area at the base of the bluff that currently is bereft of vegetation. It's a historic industrial usage area, and it would require quite a bit of work to get that into white oak habitat, but the university and the city are quite confident that we can make that a reality. I will say that with that white oak woodland area, we're adding 25,000 square feet to the bluff area. So we're actually increasing the width of the bluff corridor effect in that location. The next area is the oak woodland transition area. That's just adjacent to the oak restoration area, and that area is 31,250 square feet. That is to be managed to promote the viability of the oak restoration area. The next component of the mitigation plan is the mixed forest enhancement area. That's 87,920 square feet, and that area will be restored to provide better function, corridor function, by removing invasive plants and planting native communities, plant communities in that area. And finally is an area called the Maple Bench Restoration Area. That's 17,710 square feet. And this is an area that's currently used by the university for staging and stockpiling, and it will be restored following construction of the gateway building. So just in a nutshell, the restoration ratios through this plan, if we look at just the enhancement area, which is the maple mixed forest area and the oak woodland transition area, those two areas combined are enhancement areas. We're removing invasive species from those areas and we'll be planting native plant community in there. That's 2-to-1 ratio. The 2.4-to-1 ratio, 2.5-to-1 ratio. For restoration, which is the white oak and the maple bench area, that's actually putting trees in and vegetation where none now exists. So that's habitat creation. That is almost a 2-to-1 ratio. And when you put those two restoration and enhancement areas together, it gives you a grand total of a mitigation ratio of 4.25-to-1, which is very high for a mitigation plan. So the key elements of the agreement that are before you today is that the university will begin implementing this mitigation plan beginning in the spring of 2011, so right around the corner. The university will begin to mitigate mitigation activities for the White Oak Woodland area, begin soil preparation. Yes.
Sorry for interrupting, but can I just clarify that under this timeline, they would be required to proceed with mitigation whether or not they proceed to build on the site, correct? Or whether they get approval to build?
Correct. They have, I believe that's correct.
That's correct.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
They are making a commitment to do this mitigation in this fashion. So they begin in spring of 2011 in the Oak Woodland area, and then they would also begin to remove the invasive plants and plant understory native communities in the mixed forest enhancement area. The agreement details implementation schedules and for maintenance, monitoring, reporting, and the long-term protection of the mitigation areas through the year 2063. The mitigation plan includes long-term monitoring and unprecedented reporting on the success of the mitigation areas. Annual reports will be provided to the city for the first 10 years following installation of the oak revegetation area, followed by reports of 5 and 10-year increments through the year 2062, for a total of 50 years of direct accountability for success of the mitigation plan. The city will remove the environmental conservation overlay zone from the gateway site and will add new, tougher environmental protection overlay to the mitigation area.
Could you just explain? Yes. I don't think I've ever seen a presentation during my time in council where we went out to 2063. And since
well, I will have to say
since
that
either Randy or I will likely be president of the council at that point, just so you can remind us why we're going out that far.
I just in my head calculate I'd be in my 17th term by then.
What's the just two more to go?
The reason for that, Councillor Fish, is that the mitigation plan is undertaking white oak restoration. And in order for white oak is a very slow-growing tree. The university has committed to carrying out, if you will, a very high level of mitigation to compensate for placement of this structure in the escarpment. They want to do it right. And we've been in consultation with the university very heavily over the last 3 to 4 months on a planting plan. And so they walk into this with their eyes open that replanting white oak woodlands is not something that you just can accomplish in 5 years. It's a long-term commitment. So 2063 is essentially the point at which the white oak woodland becomes mature wood oakland conditions. And so the university is committed to going out that far and being accountable for what happens in that area. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Where are we? Okay, I am almost finished. I was mentioning that the city will remove the C-zone from the Gateway development site and will impose the protection overlay to the mitigation area. The application of the environmental protection zone is a certain level of protection for the mitigation area. There has been some concerns about the university's commitment to protecting this area out to the year 2063. It is a long time. I mean, most of us will be in a very different point of life by 2063. So what is the long-term stability of this area? So the P zone is one means of making sure this area stays in oak, white oak, and escarpment condition, natural condition. The other is the incorporation of the mitigation plan into the conditional use master plan. Again, it would take an amendment to the master plan to remove this mitigation plan. And also adhering to the terms of the agreement, which is itself a binding contract with remedies. So those three elements contribute to the longevity of this site. And I would like to just end my portion of the presentation by saying we would like to compliment the University of Portland. They've been a very willing partner, and they've gone the extra mile to develop and commit to this mitigation plan that will, if properly implemented through time, actually enhance the functions in this natural resource area. And they've agreed to an unprecedented commitment for monitoring and reporting to ensure the success of this mitigation over time.
have a question.
How is the development agreement impacted by the Land Use Board of Appeals, the LUBA appeal?
You want to answer that, or we have to wait until that is resolved?
Right. So the development agreement can be adopted. We cannot, and I'll get to that kind of in the final part of my presentation.
Keep going.
Okay.
I thought you were done, sorry.
Okay, no problem. So I was going to bring up just a few more key items related to the development agreement. And one of the primary items to keep in mind that is that this action, the removal of the conservation overlay zone and mitigation plan, does not in itself approve any development of the Gateway site. The university is committed to this plan to implement mitigation prior to coming in with a proposal for development. That proposal it's in an undefined time period. It may be several years out before they ever come to request a development of that portion of their site. That future development would be subject to a Type 3 land use review to amend their existing conditional use master plan, which governs the type of development that can occur on the university campus. And finally, although a structure for the Gateway site has not been designed at this point, the university has, as part of the development agreement, declared its intent to incorporate sustainable design principles in the future development of the Gateway site, and the amendment to the ordinance that was added by Commissioner Fritz adds language to further specify the sustainable features that will be included at the time of development. And those examples or specific types of features that are listed include bird-friendly design and construction materials, eco-roofs that provide habitat features, and screening through vegetative or other means, I believe it is now, and integration of the building footprint to the extent practicable. Finally, this should answer Commissioner Fritz's question. If Council does approve the development agreement, the city and the University of Portland will sign the agreement. The university will commence installation of the Gateway Mitigation Plan beginning in the spring of 2011. Staff will need to return to City Council to complete the zone changes at the Gateway site and the mitigation plan areas once all of the legal proceedings that currently prevent the city from amending the zoning have been resolved. So we would need to return.
Thank you.
And that wraps up the presentation. Thank you.
Discussion from Council.
So do we consider that the wildlife corridor is still intact with this proposal?
With the mitigation plan, it remains intact. In fact, it is enhanced over its current condition.
And eco-roofs could continue, if on the building, could contribute to that also?
Could definitely contribute to that, could help mitigate further the effects of the building and disturbance in the area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone signed up to testify?
Yes, we have 11 people. The first three, please come on up, are Francie Royce, Barbara Quinn, and Susan Landauer. And they'll be followed by Fletcher Tripp, Bob Solinger, and Matt Kruger.
Hi, welcome back to City Council.
Hello, how are you?
Why don't you go ahead and begin, Francie?
All right. Francie Royce, I'm speaking on behalf of NP Greenway, the North Portland Willamette Greenway Trail Advocates. I have just a couple points. One, we desire to make sure that Van Houten Street, which runs through this area, be maintained for pedestrian bike access to the future Willamette Greenway Trail. And that seems to be unclear at this point, but from the drawings, was unclear. We have some concern about the full visual. We have a lot of concern about the full visual experience that trail users have. Future trail users will have with the surrounding habitat and vegetation. And finally, I want to take this opportunity to reiterate MP Greenway's desire to be involved heavily in the master plan for the University of Portland's future development that will include the alignment of the trail through the Triangle property.
Thank you very much. Barbara?
Yeah, it's Barbara Quinn, Chair of Friends of Cathedral Park Neighborhood Association and Chair of Friends of Baltimore Woods. Thank you for letting me come in today. I'm before you today for one reason. I believe that the North Willamette Bluff system, including the site being discussed right now, is an important urban wildlife system and an equally important asset to humans. Unfortunately, it's a somewhat hidden asset to us in North Portland. It's over the edge and out of our eye or our vision. And I would really like to see that. I hope that changes in the near future, especially with the trail. I'd like to emphasize that it's a system. It's a 7-mile system throughout North Portland. It's a fairly thin corridor. The vision of the North Reach Plan is to restore upland connectivity where and when we can. And so the question is, does there need to be a connection between campuses that is a 1-acre square building, obliterating most of the current wildlife corridor, especially when there is plenty of space elsewhere on campus? Is it fair for the university to state that it has an expectation of the building when your own development review staff has said there were no plans for anything as specific as a building until 2005? There is no amount of mitigation that can truly make up for such a large structure, although heroic efforts have been made by staff. The efforts cannot replace what's being bargained away when you consider the monstrous parking structure as a centerpiece of the new so-called wildlife corridor. It will create noise, fumes, vibrations, and encourage intense human activity. The idea that we need to trade the environmental health of the Bluff corridor is one we should reject, and I use the word we loosely, since it was not we but only a few stakeholders that have truly been included in this agreement. In fact, the context of the development agreement, the North Reach Plan is supposed to include multiple stakeholders. It should be noted that there's already existing natural resources on site, 50 native trees, currently providing habitat and cover. It is wasteful to destroy them and recreate a new corridor. It is also true that the city and metro have acquired part of Baltimore's woods for $1.1 million just to the north, and it seems wasteful to then block the corridor to the south or degrade it. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Susan.
Mayor Adams, Commissioners Fish, Fritz, Leonard, and Saltzman isn't here. Thank you for letting us speak here today. On Sunday, I visited the area near the University of Portland campus. I was getting signatures on a letter that I just passed out to you. And there was a game at Merlo Stadium. I went door to door to the homes of former University of Portland Master Planning Steering Committee members, and I saw how inappropriate the parking situation is. Neighbors want relief from parking events, and they are deeply concerned by this development agreement. The university should do a transportation study, make changes, and work to improve relations with the community. The transportation study should be part of an overdue master plan. The development agreement you are considering removes the environmental conservation overlay zone and offers mitigation to allow building a signature gateway structure. By all accounts, this gateway structure would be a huge parking garage about the size of a city block, which would contain a spiral road for cars to go up and down from the main upper campus to the new river campus. We believe that the proposed mitigation, generous as it seems, cannot take the place of the existing wildlife connectivity corridor. Maybe in 50 years, but where do the critters go in the meantime? We believe that the area below the Willamette Bluff can and should be developed as part of a world-class trail system. Mother Nature was able to hide and save bits of nature in this area only because the bluff is too steep for people to easily use. we have reached the point where we need to treasure and protect the bits of nature we have left. Permanently desecrating the bluff with this parking structure would be a mistake that would be obvious to anyone with eyes. Our 7-mile stretch of the proposed trail along North Portland's Willamette River bank has potential as a Lewis and Clark destination trail. Clark's African slave York and the Native American members of the Lewis and Clark